Good morning. My name is Eli, and I'm talking about Rossi survey for supernovae and other transients. But actually, it's more a talk about other transients than supernova in that order. And I want to point your attention to posters by Robert Quimby and Sarah Yost, which are at the virtual poster session. And a lot of this work is there a laser pointer or something?
Yeah. Not that.
It's this. So, paper Rykoff et al. From past year. That should be 2005, actually. So, this is what I'm going to talk about is the robotic optical transient search experiment ROTC 3 telescope systems, which were designed for gamma ray burst follow up, but also have useful applications in transient searches. Our orphan and untriggered GRB afterglows and our search for these, then the results, and finally a search for nearby supernovae in Virgo. And this is being done by Robert Quimby at the University of Texas at one of the ROTC telescopes. So the ROTC 3 telescopes, they're half-meter class telescopes with a very wide 1.85 by 1.85 degree field of view. As you can see, M31 fits nicely in the field of view. We run unfiltered for maximum sensitivity. We have fast readout and very fast slewing. And the whole system was designed for rapid response to gamma ray burst triggers. And our median GRB alert response time is about 7 seconds. And the telescopes are all automated with no human intervention. But it was known from the beginning that the wide field of view would be good to respond not only to poorly localized gamma ray bursts, but also, which was the case in the pre-Swiss era, but also to do wide field transient search. And our limiting magnitude is around 18 to 18.5 for a 1 minute exposure. We have four of these telescopes worldwide at McDonald Observatory in Texas, the Turkish National Observatory in Turkey, Siding Spring Observatory in Australia, and the Hess site in Namibia. And I just got back 2 days ago from Namibia, where this is what it looked like before. And then we had to move it a couple hundred yards, and this is what it looks like now. So these are the Hess telescopes in the background. And they're building a giant Hess telescope right in the middle.
Are you usually taking data during the day?
No.
Shark exposure.
But it's easier to take a color photo. It's actually the rainiest rainy season since 34 in Namibia, so we were lucky to get a day where it was actually, we could open up during the day. Anyway, with our global coverage, we like to say the sun never rises on the Rossi Empire. So, what do I mean by untriggered gamma ray burst afterglows? Well, even if a satellite doesn't detect it, there are still 2 GRBs a day that are visible at the Earth. This is an extrapolation from the BATSE event rate. The advantage of looking for these is that we know what these optical afterglows look like, especially with the year of SWIFT operation. We have a very good idea of the magnitude and the decay rates of these sorts of afterglows. The disadvantage is, of course, that they're rare. You're much more likely to get them when they're triggered by a wide-field gamma ray instrument in space. Orphan GRB afterglows, on the other hand, are visible after the jet break when afterglows should be visible off-axis. That is, the gamma rays are collimated, but as the shock decelerates, then the view that the optical afterglow can be visible gets wider and wider over time, and those should be visible. The advantage is that they might be over 200 per day visible at the Earth. Yes?
Are these predictions assuming Rossi depth or?
I've not yet assumed how many we can see. This is just in general. So this is 2 a day. These are not visible to Rossi. I'll talk about that in a moment. Okay. So the Ryby 200 today. The disadvantage, we don't know what they look like, and they're probably much dimmer than what Rossi 3 can see. That's another disadvantage for us. We don't go deep enough. So our search was designed to look for the known unknown or something like that. The untriggered GRB afterglows. There's a certain baseline, a rate of events that must be there. These are these untriggered GRB afterglows. And if we find an excess above that rate, then we learn something more about gamma ray burst emission, optical emission. But how much coverage is required for a Rossi search? 2 GRBs a day visible from the Earth. About 50% of these have visible afterglows. And this is both pre-SWIFT and with SWIFT. It's on the order of 50%. So if we have one per day per 40,000 square degrees of sky, we need around 110 square degree years of effective coverage to catch an untriggered GRB afterglow, assuming your search is sensitive to 100% of the afterglows. And I'll show you how well how close we come to that. So our search strategy is to try to get as much coverage as possible. Can we even come close to that 100 square degree years? So our search parameters, with a limiting magnitude of 18.5, we can determine how long we can see a typical afterglow. Our search needs to be very rapid. We need rapid identification for follow-up. If you find them now and don't realize it until a year from now, then it's gone, and you can't really identify it as an afterglow or extragalactic or what. So we can get spectra while the transient is still bright, assuming that we find some candidates. And we search the equatorial stripe, covered by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, for deep 5-band background images. The equatorial stripe is nice because these fields are visible at high elevation at all our telescopes in both the northern and southern hemispheres. And then it's nice to have 23rd magnitude 5-color imaging, so if we see something flare up, we have a very deep background image, and we can determine if there's a host galaxy, perhaps, or if there's a faint counterpart. So our strategy involves we are not using image subtraction. We're just looking for new objects. And we take pairs of images, each pair separated by 30 minutes. That's our cadence. By doing pairs, we reduce the chance of hot pixel transients, cosmic ray coincidences, all of that sort of stuff. And our effective coverage time with this cadence is about 30 minutes if we assume that a typical afterglow is brighter than our limiting magnitude for 1 hour. All of these things are very scalable depending on how you determine your typical afterglow. I'll show you how we do compared to real afterglows in a moment. But in general, Rossi 3 can see an afterglow for around an hour. So a transient candidate must be a new object, not detected in 4 images. And we reject stars that are already in our template images. And our efficiency is around greater than 80% for most of our fields at high galactic latitudes. So we aren't cutting out that much of the sky. If we did image subtraction, we'd have a lot more computation, and we wouldn't gain that very, very much in the search. But we are not sensitive to objects with bright counterparts, that is, flares from bright stars, or supernovae from well-detected galaxies. This search is not tailored to look for that sort of event. We also are using these fields to look for variables and other things. We have undergrads working on that now. So our results, the latest numbers that I have compiled are through a year ago. The numbers haven't changed much since. We have a little bit more coverage. But with 1.74 square degrees a year of coverage, let's say, I think we have another square degree year of coverage in the past year, but it doesn't, it's still a factor of 50 less than the necessary 110 square degree year coverage that we would need to have a good chance of finding an untriggered afterglow. And these are with limiting magnitudes better than 17.5. The search is ongoing. It's continuing right now. And what we have found are 4 new cataclysmic variables. Actually, I think it's 5 now, all with faint counterparts with a magnitude dimmer than 20. And we found 1 flare star, 2 supernovae from dwarf galaxies. I'll talk a little bit more about those in a moment. We have no unidentified unknown transients. And we've also found many, many rocks. Especially, even with a half-hour cadence, a slow-moving asteroid near retrograde can just sit there. We found one that sat there for more than 24 hours. But we started over a year ago to avoid low ecliptic latitudes. And that greatly reduces the number of rocks. Also, the MP Checker database in the past few years, its completeness has gone way up, and I don't think we've actually seen an unknown asteroid in our search in over a year. So, the gray that's on this doesn't show up on the screen. So this is our results, our sensitivity coverage. There should be a gray box, and up here is the ROTSI-1 coverage of the ROTSI-1 transient search that was performed by Bob Kehoe many years ago. So, plotted are all the optical afterglows that were observed within the first hour up through May of last year. There's actually quite a larger number now, though it doesn't change very much. And about 50% of these afterglows are within our coverage range, and about 50% are too dim for us to catch. And 030329 actually is way up here and would have been visible. Another burst like that. And so what this shows us is that about 50% of bursts have afterglows, and our search is sensitive to about 50% of those. So the ROTSI search is sensitive to about a quarter of all gamma ray bursts should show up in this, but that means we need around 200 square degree years of coverage. So what can we answer from this? Are gamma ray bursts spherical fireballs? So this is kind of a crazy model, but let's ask a question. What if the optical emission is not beamed, but the gamma ray emission is? It's not very physical, but it's something we can put limits on. So for the Batsy rate, if we have a double jet, the number of observable bursts is around 1,500 over theta max squared events per year. That's if the optical is isotropic. But our untriggered afterglow rate is less than 78,000 events per year at 95% confidence. And that means that theta max must be greater than around 4 degrees. And so we're finding we're reaching the range where it's inconsistent that the optical will be isotropic. Yes? Oh, sorry. And finally, a little bit about our supernovae from dwarf galaxies. In June 2005, we found 2 supernovae. That's within a week. We haven't found any others from this. We are only sensitive to supernovae from dwarf galaxies. Here's the discovery image, and here's a light curve. And here's the SDSS host. It's just a faint blue smudge. So the supernova is much brighter than the galaxy itself. And we're calculating the rate of this. It's hard to find the find the exact numbers of blue galaxies. But this blind search has implications for high-G supernovae. So transitioning from there into the Texas supernova search, this is work by Robert Quimby. The goal is to discover and spectroscopically follow the youngest possible supernovae when the spectra is different and you can discover new things about the supernovae. So we have nightly observations of thousands of galaxies in the Virgo, Ursa Major, and Coma clusters. And there are hundreds of bright nearby galaxies, thousands of nearby dwarf galaxies, and tens of thousands of background Z of 0.03 galaxies in these fields. It's performed with image subtraction in near real time, and the limiting magnitude around 18 can catch a Virgo supernova in 1 to 2 days from the time of explosion. The pipeline, observations are taken at the Rossi 3D telescope again during the day. The images get copied over to a dedicated image subtraction computer. And here's new reference and no candidates right here. But all the candidates are put on a web page at University of Texas where undergraduates find something. And if they see something new, it gets put in for spectroscopic follow-up at the HET that night or the next night. And we also continue to observe the fields for an unfiltered light curve at Rossi 3B. So far, they've discovered 14 supernovae and two others, first reported by others, including 2006X. It's a little disappointing. Here's a pre-discovery image, and there it is. So unfortunately, the weather was poor in Texas for the week prior, so it wasn't caught. It wasn't initially discovered by Rossi 3B. And here's 7 novae and an LBV and M31. Now we know a lot more about these M31 novae. And also lots of bright variable stars. So first results, 2005 CG. This was one discovered by my transient search on Rossi 3C. However, we caught it very early, well before maximum light, and got spectra and multiple times from the HET. And here is the earliest spectrum, and here is at maximum light. And at the earliest time, you can see the high velocity SI2 line that evolves over time. So if you want to know more, you can see Quimby et al. 2006. And there's evidence for a detonation phase in a normal type 1A supernova. So, in conclusion, on the transient search, achieving the necessary coverage to detect untriggered GRB afterglows is difficult. It requires a lot of coverage and a lot of deep coverage. But what we're finding is that orphans are not as bright as on-axis optical afterglows, and that is not a surprise, but it's also a bit of phase space that had not been previously discovered. But also, there are not a lot of unknown transients brighter than 18th magnitude that are bright on the scale of about an hour. We aren't being swamped with these sorts of things. Many low redshift supernovae from dwarf galaxies are missed by targeted searches, and this might have implications for high Z supernova searches. And finally, the Texas supernova search is discovering nearby supernovae right now and obtaining early spectra.
Question. How much sky do you cover per night?
How much sky? We cover typically on one telescope, but we repeat the same fields on each telescope. About 100 fields, and each is 3.5 square degrees.
And for each position of the sky, you have only 2 visits, basically, half an hour or more.
We only have one pair of images and then another pair of images a half hour later. Yeah.
That's per night.
Per night.
Yeah.
Thanks.
But if the weather's good everywhere, then it actually ends up being 8 times per night. But the weather's never good everywhere. Yes.
You talked about rates of untriggered gamma ray bursts. Mm-hmm. Do you take into account where swift, heady, integral are pointing in that number?
No, I'm just saying that this is right. That assuming that swift is only finding a small percentage of them, this is just from the BATSE rate extrapolated to the all sky. So let's say 10 years from now, swift is gone, and there's you know, and glass, something horrible happens to it, then there's nothing up there. God forbid. Yeah.
So can you go back to the slide where you show the probability of detection where you get 50% inside your contours?
Yeah.
Can you explain why you're not getting the really bright piece?
Because we have saturation cuts, actually. So we have a cut here. If it's 10th magnitude very quickly, then it would show up as a big saturated blob.
But you at least know it would be there.
You would know it's, but we, since most of the saturation things are, the bleed trails make it, they would show up, but they get rejected by the cuts that we have.
Okay.
So we are cutting on this, but at the same time, you can't see, the ROTC1 search actually did cover that with much better coverage and didn't find anything, and so.
Okay. What fraction of Swift GRBs are you able to follow reasonably fast, like, you know, within a minute or two?
You should see Sarah's virtual poster, Sarah Yost's virtual poster. But it's around 35% of Swift gamma ray bursts we can respond to promptly. That's within, you know, seconds.
And you're able to put good limits, which is to say you're able to get to about 18th magnitude, right?
Not on every, I mean, some of those, you know, unfortunately, a significant fraction are, you know, near twilight and such like the one.
Plus 5 second images on 60.
What? Oh, plus we take 5 second images at first, not 60 second images. We take ever increasing them. Yeah, good point.
So I have some vague memories of a few years ago being at a Raptor talk where they said there was interesting stuff happening there. Now, maybe, of course, that's design, but someone's
right. Tom, best friend.
Yeah. Does Raptor agree that there's nothing interesting right underneath him?
No, we don't.
I'm not saying that there's nothing interesting brighter than 18. I say that there's nothing unknown that we're finding at that level. But I don't know if Raptor has...
Well, this, there's a lot of assumptions put in this. For example, that there's a power law decay, for example.
Tom.
I'll show you an example tomorrow of one that 40 minutes later came out of nowhere and got up to 16.2 magnitude.
Tom, let me just say something. there's no assumption over the shape of the light curve when we're looking for things. The only assumption is for the coverage that we have. We have to assume a shape of the light curve in order to get a contour. But when we're searching, we have no cuts on what it looks like.
Yeah, but you built into your search an assumption.
We did built in a half-hour cadence, built on the bursts that we know that are typically brighter than the ROTC limits for about an hour. That's what we know. And that's what that cadence was built on.
Sure, the half-hour cadence also gives you a separation between moving transients and non-moving transients. That's the solar system.
So I have two questions. Sure. So coming back to your supernova, you said, well, you're finding supernova from dwarf galaxies, mm-hmm. which are obviously not targeted by solar mm-hmm. cage and so on. I'm not sure what implication it has for the more distant searches, unless the supernova are intrinsically fainter.
Well, I think that, right. That, I mean, we
otherwise,
don't.
In fact, you could turn it around and say, maybe looking at the host galaxies of these more distant ones, if you want to know the kinds of supernova host galaxies, then obviously you don't use the Kate sample, you use a redshift 0.1 sample, 0.2.
Mm-hmm. Right, no, because the distant ones are, you know, more of a blind search because you don't, as you were pointing out, you don't have, you know, even to 300 megaparsecs, you can't target fields out there. So
it's not clear what the implications are, unless you're showing some correlation. I don't know. Are these doing anything special?
No, actually, I think the implications might be that they're they look just like the other type 1A. Okay. So it might be.
Okay, well, then the other question I had was the DLS survey had, after asteroids and supernovae, their biggest contamination of flare stars.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly enough, you have, I don't know this.
We just found one flare star.
I know, you had only one flare star, but four CVs, mm-hmm. two supernovae. So it must be small number statistics or something. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, they never found a CV.
Okay.
I think that's right now.
It's all flare stars. Okay. It's been, so
well,
hard.
What's the difference between the
intensity of stars, right? ELS is nothing.
They're
painted.
Yeah.
They're
painted.
Trying to
avoid.
We have much less exposure, also.
Yeah. But we did, you know, these are actually four new CVs that we found, and several of. Two or three of them have actually outburst more than once during our search, so. I don't. So they're. We have in the paper there's a rate of CV outbursts per year, but they aren't from all new unknown CVs.
Well, the first implication that comes to my mind that is suggested by your supernova detected in dwarf galaxy, mm-hmm. and then maybe this can explain the mystery of a so-called intergalactic supernova. There are four or five supernovae, mm-hmm. mostly Taiwan A, for which it's not clear what is the parent galaxy. Mm-hmm. Maybe they come from.
Those were in clusters, though, weren't they?
No, not always.
No, okay.
Since they have been detected on photographic plates, because they are old stars, maybe they didn't have enough sensitivity to detect the low surface brightness of the parent galaxy. Mm-hmm. And maybe you're providing a good mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're actually trying to calculate a rate of per luminosity from these.
Don't calculate. I am reading that.
Okay.
Asteroid people claim that their catalogs are complete at 99% level mm-hmm. to roughly B of 19. Mm-hmm. So did you try to use their catalogs to predict where asteroids would be and decrease contaminants?
There really aren't that many. And because of this, so it, depending on the season and all of these things, so you might get a few in a night, but then you click on MP Checker and it says asteroid, and you say, okay, it doesn't take that many brain minutes from an undergrad to reject them, because they're complete. But when we started this a few years ago, it wasn't as complete, and it's actually gotten a lot easier now.
I assume everybody with their laptops open is actually looking at the virtual poster session.
Yeah.
Just reminded me to remind